Today is Thursday, April 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The University of Oxford pauses an AstraZeneca vaccine trial in children and teens.
The trial's disruption is just the latest blow for AstraZeneca's vaccine, once hailed as a milestone in the fight against the pandemic.
Plus, Iranian authorities announced that the nation has made over 50 kilograms of highly enriched uranium.
Iran's hardline parliament passed a law late last year that required the state to make 120 kilograms.
And the trial of Derek Chauvin continues. We'll have these stories and more next. The University of Oxford said on Tuesday that it had paused a small British trial testing the COVID-19 vaccine it developed with AstraZeneca in children and teenagers as it awaits for more data on rare blood clotting issues. Reuters' Floor Bradley Watson starts us off.
The trial's disruption is just the latest blow for AstraZeneca's vaccine, once hailed as a milestone in the fight against the pandemic. Oxford University said while there were no safety concerns in the pediatric trial, it would await guidance from the UK drugs watchdog before administering any more shots. The European Medicines Agency is expected to announce this week the results of a review into the vaccine and its potential link to an extremely rare brain blood clot known as cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. A high proportion of the reported cases were among younger women, but many experts say there's no definitive evidence yet of a particular risk for that group. The World Health Organization says it expects no changes to its assessment that the shot's benefits outweigh any risks. Dozens of countries have approved the use of the vaccine, and millions of doses of it have been safely administered around the world. However, Germany, France, and the Netherlands have restricted its use to their older populations while investigations continue.
Floor Bradley Watson reports for Reuters News. Italy is recommending that AstraZeneca's COVID-19 shot only be used on those over 60. Meanwhile, Britain says that people under 30 should get an alternative. European Union health ministers have thus far failed to agree on common guidance on use of the shot. This despite calls for coordination across member states to combat public hesitancy over the vaccine, said to be a key component of many vaccination programs. Now, that being said, after being criticized for its slow rollout, Europe is ramping up its coronavirus vaccinations. The faster pace is being seen in France this week, where the country has launched a mass vaccination campaign and witnessed the first vaccine doses roll out from a French factory. Lisa Bryant has that part of the story.
The Stade de France soccer stadium outside Paris is usually home to thousands of rowdy fans. But the people passing through its doors these days are mostly seniors with another goal, getting their first coronavirus shot. As of this week, the stadium counts among France's new so-called vaccinodromes, 40 giant spaces being repurposed into COVID-19 vaccination centers, each capable of inoculating thousands of people a week. This one at the heart of Saint-Denis is based in one of France's poorest regions, with some of the country's highest coronavirus caseloads. It's putting shots in arms just as the first French factory, Delpharm, began churning out Pfizer-BioNTech shots Wednesday west of Paris.
Si les choses se déroulent bien et elles se dérouleront bien, d'ici la fin de l'année...
European Union Internal Market Commissioner Thierry Breton says this is only the beginning. He says Europe will be the world's top COVID-19 vaccine producer by the end of 2021, delivering up to 3 billion injections. A big share of that total will come from France, where five factories are expected to roll out millions of doses each month. Breton's words bring hope during otherwise grim times in many parts of Europe. Here in France, the country has gone into its third nationwide lockdown amid surging coronavirus cases. Hospitals are struggling with more than 5,000 people in intensive care. Scott Marcus, senior fellow at economic research organization Bruegel, is not surprised by Breton's promise of a massive vaccine ramp-up.
The historic experience is that Europe is a pharma powerhouse. A large fraction of vaccines have historically come from Europe.
But the EU has earned a very different reputation recently. It's been sharply criticized for its sluggish vaccine rollout, which sees the bloc lagging well behind countries like the United States, Britain, and Israel. The World Health Organization recently called Europe's pace unacceptably slow. Citizen wariness of the AstraZeneca shot amid mixed government messages and fears of potential side effects hasn't helped. France is feeling a special blow. The country is proud of its medical research. Now, some point out, it's the only United Nations Security Council member that hasn't successfully produced its own vaccine. French factories will instead be rolling out Pfizer, Moderna, and other vaccines originally created by non-French companies. Prominent centrist politician François Bayrou called it a sign of France's decline. Analyst Daniel Gross, a board member of the Brussels-based Center for European Policy Studies, looks at the problem another way. He is confident Europe can ramp up vaccine production.
Europe is actually not too bad at making things, and things which are a bit complicated to make. I think they can do and will do.
He is less confident that Europe can learn bigger lessons from its slow start.
The EU has a decision-making mechanism which is just not suitable for a crisis where you need quick executive action. It's not what the EU is made for.
For analyst Marcus, Europe's vaccine response highlights another problem. He praises the bloc for banding together last year in ordering vaccines, but he points to recent clashes over how vaccines are now being distributed among member states.
The minute that things start to go sour, there's a temptation for every country to go its own way. At times when we need to pull together on the oars, there's a risk that we won't be pulling together. It's a genuine concern.
Polls show many European citizens are also unhappy with the region's response. At the Stade de France, this middle-aged couple called it shameful how some countries are failing to fairly share the shots.
Les deux ont capitalisé.
Les deux, parce que de toute façon, il y a un problème d'approvisionnement de vaccins.
Nicolas, who lives near the stadium, agrees Europe's vaccine rollout could have been better. In fact, everything could have been better, he says, and he's hoping things will change. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Saint-Denis, France.
The number of coronavirus cases is rising in the United States, and it's being linked to a variant of the virus. The AP's Ed Donahue explains.
The variant was first identified in Britain.
The B117 variant is now the most common lineage circulating in the United States.
CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky says this variant has a different demographic.
Across the country, we are hearing reports of clusters of cases associated with daycare centers and youth sports. Hospitals are seeing more and more younger adults, those in their 30s and 40s.
Walensky is encouraging areas with rising case numbers to limit or suspend youth sports. She says people need to take individual responsibility to get vaccinated when they can. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Scientists forecast that Brazil's surge in COVID-19 deaths will soon surpass the worst of a record January wave in the United States. Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder is up next.
With nearly 337,000 lives lost to the pandemic, Brazil's COVID-19 death toll only trails the US, where the average for daily deaths peaked at 3,285 in January. But while vaccinations may help curb the US outbreak, Brazil's healthcare system is overwhelmed. The country has seen record new deaths from COVID-19 every week for the past 2 months, fueled by a more contagious local variant and minimal social distancing efforts. And in the last year, by one recent tally, poverty has nearly tripled as the pandemic grinds the economy down to a crawl. Marcelo Neri, director of a think tank on Brazilian development, says there needs to be more focus on vaccines.
Financial assistance is not a solution to the problem. The solution can be vaccination. As long as the vaccine does not arrive, we need solutions that allow people to comply with social distancing and stay at home.
President Jair Bolsonaro has begun embracing vaccines he once scorned, though the far-right politician continues to fight in the courts against social distancing restrictions. He's also come under rising political pressure to act. Bolsonaro responded with a dramatic shake-up of a half-dozen ministries earlier this week, putting loyalists in key roles ahead of a potentially tough re-election campaign next year against his political nemesis.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder India has been recording the highest numbers of COVID-19 cases in the world as it grapples with a second wave of the pandemic. As Anjana Pasricha reports, the impact of the massive surge of the virus in the world's biggest vaccine maker will be felt far beyond its shores as India slows vaccine shipments to other countries.
Many in India stopped following COVID protocols as cases dropped earlier this year. The price? A second wave that has climbed more swiftly than the first, making India the world's COVID-19 hotspot.
There was a general feeling of comfort across all sections, including the policymakers and particularly the public, that we had seen the end of the epidemic. And there was a feeling that herd immunity had somehow been acquired, and that was going to protect India from any further inroads of the virus. This was absolutely a misconception.
As the country's daily tally crossed 100,000 cases this week, worst affected regions such as Maharashtra state reimposed restrictions. Its capital, Mumbai, shut down shops, restaurants and beaches and imposed a weekend curfew. Delhi has imposed a night curfew. That is worrying the millions who had returned to casual jobs in cities that had resumed normal life after a stringent lockdown.
Last year, we had no work for 6 to 7 months. We were all sitting at home. Only we know how we coped.
To stem the rapid rise of infections, India has boosted its inoculation drive. Health officials this month have begun targeting the younger age group, believed to be driving the rising numbers. There is still a long way to go. Although the more than 87 million jabs administered so far are among the largest in the world, they account for less than 7% of the population. To meet its massive need, India has slowed down vaccine deliveries to countries from Indonesia to Africa that are critically dependent on the world's largest vaccine producer. Amid concern that the temporary hold will impact rollouts in many developing countries, India has defended its decision.
We have supplied vaccines to more than 80 countries across the world. We have already stated that our external supplies would be done keeping in mind our domestic requirements. At this time, I'm sure our partners understand that vaccines are primarily purposed for domestic consumption.
India's second wave could determine the course of the pandemic, not just in the vast South Asian nation, but other countries too. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Iranian authorities have announced that the country has made over 50 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. Emily Wither from Reuters News takes it from here.
As the U.S. and Iran hold indirect talks over a possible return to the 2015 nuclear deal, Iranian authorities have revealed that they've produced 55 kilograms of highly enriched uranium, indicating quicker production than a goal set by Parliament. Partly in reaction to former President Donald Trump pulling out of the nuclear accord, Iran's hardline parliament passed a law late last year that required the state to make 120 kilograms. A spokesman from the Atomic Energy Agency said Iran's production rate is already up to 40% faster than that. Enriching to 20% is a big step towards reaching weapons grade. The disclosure comes as Tehran and Washington enter a second day of talks in Vienna, so far described as constructive. In January, Iran began enriching uranium to 20% at Fordow, an underground uranium enrichment site that was built in secret inside a mountain, possibly to withstand any aerial bombardment. It's all part of a recent acceleration of its breaches of the nuclear deal that stipulated Tehran was not allowed to enrich uranium at Fordow at all.
Reuters' Emily Wither. Myanmar's ambassador to London told Reuters News that he was locked out of the embassy on Wednesday, with sources saying his deputy had shut him out of the building and taken charge on behalf of the military. London ambassador Jarzawar Min has broken ranks with the ruling junta in recent weeks, calling for the release of detained civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi. In addition, troops in Myanmar opened fire on pro-democracy protesters on Wednesday. Local media and activists say at least 15 people were killed and even more were wounded. the latest victims of a campaign to crush opposition of the ruling military junta. Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, the leader of the army coup that ousted Myanmar's elected government on February 1st, says the civil disobedience movement's aim is to destroy the country. But a London-based research group says the military is losing control. In other unrest on Wednesday, a series of small blasts hit the commercial capital of Yangon and a Chinese-owned factory was set afire. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners says about 600 civilians have been killed by security forces in the turmoil since the coup, as nationwide protests and strikes have persisted despite the bloodshed. The Minneapolis Police Department's coordinator on the use of force told jurors on Wednesday the neck restraint applied by former policeman Derek Chauvin in the deadly arrest of George Floyd was unauthorized and that officers are trained to use the least amount of force necessary. Reuters' Chris Dignam.
Prosecutors tried to illustrate that Chauvin disregarded his training in the deadly arrest of George Floyd, showing their witness, Lieutenant Johnny Mercil, who teaches the proper use of force for the Minneapolis police, an image of Chauvin kneeling on the neck of the handcuffed 46-year-old.
A knee on the neck would be something that does happen in use of force that isn't unauthorized.
And under what circumstances would that be authorized? How long can you do that?
I don't know if there's a time frame. It would depend on the circumstances of the time.
Which would include what?
The type of resistance you're getting from the subject that you're putting the knee on.
And so if there was, the subject was under control and handcuffed, would this be authorized?
I would say no.
The defense tried to argue that the chaotic scene on May 25th of last year made real-time decisions extremely difficult.
Ultimately, if that person were to be handcuffed and circumstances dictated, the officer would be permitted to continue to hold his knee in that same position. Agreed?
I would say yes. However, we've cautioned officers that be mindful of the neck area and to look for the shoulder.
The MPD's crisis intervention and medical support coordinators also testified, as well as an outside use of force expert from the LAPD, who said he had closely examined Chauvin's actions during the deadly arrest.
My opinion was that the force was excessive.
Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges for Floyd's arrest on suspicion he used a fake $20 bill to buy cigarettes.
Chris Dignam from Reuters. Security at the U.S. Capitol is once again under consideration after the second deadly attack on U.S. Capitol Police in less than 3 months. The building, known as the People's House, previously had been widely accessible to the public before the January 6 riots. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson discusses with me about the tough decisions before U.S. officials as they try to keep the seat of U.S. democracy open to the public.
That is absolutely right. You know, I work in the U.S. Capitol building every day, and I work in the most accessible of all U.S. government buildings. The White House, most government agencies, the Pentagon, you have to go through a security check to get into any of those buildings. But that's not the case for the U.S. Congress. This is the People's House, as you mentioned. These are the lawmakers that we elect to represent us in Washington, D.C. And the entire idea of the U.S. Capitol is that the people who elect those lawmakers are able to go into the building, observe them at work when they're in session or at hearings. And all of that has been undermined by the events of all these past 3 months that have really called into question the balance between security versus accessibility. And what's really interesting about the attack last Friday is that it came just as they were taking down the outside perimeter security fencing. So ever since the January 6th riot, there were two rings of security fencing around the U.S. Capitol. The inner security ring with the barbed wire, that is still in place as of now, as we speak. What happened on Friday was that the attacker went to a vehicle checkpoint, which is intended to make sure that you are a secure person who can enter that inner ring of the U.S. Capitol complex. All of the security analysts that I've spoken to have said, look, even though a U.S. Capitol police officer died in this attack, the system did work here in terms of keeping that attacker from getting any closer to the U.S. Capitol.
So the system worked in terms of preventing an attacker getting to those that are operating inside the most secure areas of the Capitol, those who are carrying out the legislative duties of the country. But moving forward, you know, what are you hearing in terms of plans to make this final security adjustment after the January 6th riot?
Right. Yeah. So the attack on Friday was very different in nature from the January 6th riot, as we know, when thousands of pro-Trump rioters overwhelmed Capitol security forces. That's a very different security issue. And they have to, lawmakers are really planning out really in-depth ways to look at how they can avoid that particular situation. There was a security review that was released last month that had a number of recommendations, including making up the shortfall in the U.S. Capitol Police Force. I don't know if people know, but we're only talking about 2,300 people who are guarding the entire U.S. Capitol complex and U.S. lawmakers, in addition to the thousands of staff that work there every day, journalists, custodial. This is a small city that only 2,300 people are being asked to guard. And everyone is saying that immediately there has to be more hiring and there has to be a bigger budget. There is also some discussion about some mobile permanent fencing that can be moved around the Capitol grounds to accommodate different security concerns, as well as some mounted Capitol police who can immediately address some of the other issues that may come up during First Amendment protests, which is something no lawmaker wants to ban on the U.S. Capitol grounds, because that would be a terrible image to send around the world for American democracy. There has to be some balance between keeping the grounds open for the people and making sure that something like January 6th never happens again.
Have they set any kind of guidelines as to when they hope to wrap things up and have a final recommendation for the security parameters?
A lot of that is tied into the bigger commission over the events of January 6th that is still being fiercely debated among lawmakers about the makeup of that commission, how they're going to operate in their work. We, of course, do already have that security review from a retired lieutenant general. And then we have a whole rush of congressional hearings because, of course, Congress has oversight over the U.S. Capitol Police. They're continuing the work that they've done since January 6th to examine the events and to start putting some more security recommendations into place. But of course, as with everything on Capitol Hill, this is a political issue. There's a battle between Democrats who want enhanced security measures and Republicans who are saying that all of those fences need to come down. That's going to be a political debate that we're going to have to watch play out over the next few weeks. And the Friday attack may play a role in kind of pushing that discussion forward and hastening it towards its end.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Biden administration has announced its plans to provide $235 million in U.S. aid to the Palestinians. The move restarts funding for the United Nations Agency supporting refugees and restores other assistance cut off by then-President Donald Trump. This report is produced by Reuters' Zachary Goldman.
The aid will flow primarily to the United Nations Relief Works Agency, or UNRWA, which provides schools, food, and shelter to Palestinian refugees in the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Speaking to Reuters in the Jordanian capital, the head of UNRWA on Wednesday said the funds couldn't come soon enough.
The situation has been absolutely terrible, and there was a feeling of abandonment from the international community.
The package is part of an effort to repair U.S. ties with the Palestinians that all but collapsed during Trump's tenure. The Trump administration blocked nearly all aid after it severed ties with the Palestinian Authority in 2018. That move was widely seen as an attempt to force the Palestinians to negotiate with Israel on terms the Palestinian leadership said would deny them a viable state. Biden's aides have also signaled that they want to reestablish the goal of a negotiated two-state solution as a priority in U.S. policy on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The United States is committed to advancing prosperity, security, and freedom for both Israelis and Palestinians in tangible ways in the immediate term, which is important in its own right, of course, but also as a means to advance towards a negotiated two-state solution.
But they have moved cautiously so far, and any major steps are likely to wait for the dust to clear after Israel's inconclusive March election, which will be followed by Palestinian elections scheduled in coming months.
Reuters reporter Zachary Goldman. The first ever West Africa Joint Operations Regional Exercise went for the heart of extremism in Africa. The operation focused on the nations of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, but tackled the threat not through the military, but through the law enforcement and justice systems. VOA's Anita Powell has that story.
About 80 law enforcement and judiciary officers participated in last week's inaugural program.
a small figure compared to the thousands of personnel who usually take part in military-led counterterrorism exercises. But this modest exercise, which recently concluded, could have a big impact against terrorism, said Julie Cabus, Deputy Assistant Secretary and Assistant Director of the Training Directorate in the State Department's Bureau of Diplomatic Security.
For this exercise, we focused on gathering timely, accurate evidence while working with judicial authorities to ensure adherence to local laws. Goals of the exercise included enhancing the investigative capacity and capability of units focused on terrorism cases in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, ensuring investigations adhere to the rule of law and the principles of human rights, and facilitating regional cross-border cooperation by sharing best practices.
Her U.S. federal agency is responsible for securing diplomacy and protecting the integrity of U.S. travel documents. Because of its global mandate, the service has the largest geographic reach of any U.S. federal law enforcement agency, with more than 270 offices outside the U.S. Michael Gonzalez, Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of African Affairs, says the small targeted efforts form an important part of the State Department's counterterrorism strategy in West Africa's Sahel region, which include the countries that participated in the exercise, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. All three of those nations have seen a rise in terrorist activity in recent years. Gonzalez.
Ultimately, addressing the challenges in Sahel will require security interventions. But ultimately, the answer to the challenges of the Sahel lies in addressing the crisis of state legitimacy and delivering governance and services to marginalized communities. And so this West Africa joint operation exercise that we saw last month is a really good example of the U.S. partnering with our partner countries in the region to develop their capacity so that they can gain greater confidence of their publics by effectively delivering accountability and follow-up to the security threats that are posed to communities.
Cabus added that her bureau has been asked to look at running a similar exercise in southern Africa, in the coastal nation of Mozambique, where violent extremists linked to Islamic State have recently stepped up their deadly attacks. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Negotiations over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam has failed to make progress. David Doyle from Reuters has this update.
Egypt's president has warned Ethiopia of the risk of conflict over its giant dam on the Blue Nile. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi was speaking after talks between the two countries and Sudan over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam failed to make any progress. Egypt is concerned about the impact of the dam on its supply of Nile waters, and Sudan is worried about its own water flows. At the opening of a new government complex, Sisi said, I am telling our brothers in Ethiopia, let's not reach a point where you touch a drop of water from Egypt, because all options are open. Referencing past regional conflicts, Sisi added that the costs of such confrontations were known. Egypt and Sudan were coordinating, he said, adding that cooperation and agreement were better than anything else. Sudan's irrigation minister, Yasser Abbas, also warned on Wednesday that all options are open, and said it was no exaggeration that the dam affects Sudanese national security. Sudan is already locked in a border dispute with Ethiopia. On Tuesday, Egypt accused Ethiopia of a lack of political will after the talks in Democratic Republic of Congo and ahead of a second filling of the dam this summer. Ethiopia is pinning its hopes of economic development and power generation on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, and it said it could not enter into an agreement that infringed on its rights to use the Nile. Ethiopia's water minister, Selassie Bekele, had no comment on Sisi's statement, but said they were utilizing water from Ethiopia for our dire need, without causing significant harm to their neighbors.
That was Reuters reporter David Doyle, and you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, or desktop computer to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well Be safe and have a great day.